From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. This episode, it's been a lovely spring, but we are going to pay a price for it later. Then, when deaf becomes a choice, what happens to deaf schools? We travel to a classroom in California where they're teaching students math through music. Then the secret hunt for the real mastermind of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and music from the international star known as Gotye. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Our cover story today. Nice weather we've been having.
Today's weather had a lot of folks thinking spring has sprung.
And people our unusually warm temperatures lately have many green-thumbed Iowans already hitting their local greenhouses.
With weather that we usually see in mid-June, folks are getting a jump on sprucing up the outside.
We're doing things that we would normally do maybe in late April, early May.
Local news from Burlington, Vermont, Des Moines, Iowa, and Cleveland, Ohio. Throughout the month of March, you've probably heard the same stories on your local news. Across the country, more than 7,700 daily temperature records broken last month on the heels of the fourth warmest winter on record. Sure, it may be time to lay on a blanket in the park, but climate scientists are worried. They say all these sunny days are actually an extreme weather event, one with local and global implications. Let's start in Iowa, where March was so hot.
A record-breaking 84 degrees hot, to be exact.
Some crops in Iowa are now running way ahead of schedule. Joe Prasaki, a statistician with the USDA, says this time of year, the state usually has just 7% of its oats planted.
And right now, they're at 58% planted. Well, that's because if you plant the crop now, it's going to germinate and grow.
Wow, so they've planted more than half of their crop already.
True.
It's hard to say whether that could be good for farmers, since crops could still get hit with frost as late as April or May, and then you're in trouble.
You could be in trouble, yes.
And if you've got allergies, maybe you already are in trouble.
We probably won't see much relief until midsummer when things do calm down.
Jim Sublett is an allergist in Louisville, Kentucky. He said patients have been coming to him with runny noses, itchy eyes, even asthma flare-ups since mid-February.
Which is probably about a month earlier. The problem with that is because of the longer exposure, those people may be at risk of having more severe problems as the season goes along.
So if you start earlier, you just suffer longer.
That's exactly right.
In Vermont, they're dreading early leaves for an entirely different reason. Arnold Coombs is a seventh-generation maple syrup farmer.
It used to be when I was a kid, you would never tap a tree before what we call town meeting day, which is the first Tuesday of March. This year, you had to be tapping by the second week just to get those first runs of sap.
Every spring, syrup farmers have to move fast because when trees sprout leaves, it changes the chemical composition of the syrup.
As soon as that change happens, the syrup is not very good. Now, the problem this year is that happened very early.
So production is down. You may see syrup prices up this year. You may also see higher crime, says Martin Flask, director of public safety in Cleveland.
Well, you know, Cleveland is normally a cold Midwest city.
Even though in the long term, crime is trending downward throughout the country and in Cleveland, homicides and burglaries are up compared to this time last year.
And we've seen a significant spike that, in our mind, can be caused by nothing else other than the weather.
Scientists say we'll probably see more mosquitoes, more Lyme disease, more accidents since people are outside more, biking, hiking, and driving. Heidi Cullen, a climatologist with the research organization Climate Central, has been closely following our spring heat wave. And I asked her, how unusual is this spring heat?
You know, I think this past March, it's hard to really get a sense of how big of a deal it was for, you know, colleagues of mine in the National Weather Service. It was crazy. I mean, we were breaking records by upwards of 40 degrees. I mean, it was this really ironic extreme weather event because it was one of these rare extreme weather events that you were just like, I'm loving this. But at the same time, it was incredibly, incredibly unusual.
Because it's hard to view a nice warm spring day as an extreme weather event.
Absolutely. You know, and I think this is actually one of the challenges of talking about climate in many ways, because even heat waves, you know, when they're happening in the midst of July or August, they're hard to really visualize.
Right. Because these would be considered normal temperatures just later in the year.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago broke records for April in March. It was incredibly unusual.
So these massive tornadoes in Texas this week, we know that scientists are hesitant to link tornado outbreaks to climate change. Why?
We're still studying tornadoes, and there's such small-scale events that they're difficult to really embrace and understand the physics of. But at the same time, we're seeing this sort of shifting of Tornado Alley. It's sort of moving further east. We know that the warm Gulf and these warm temperatures certainly help contribute to the formation of these tornadoes. So,
because the people on the other side say, well, we just report them more, people see them more,
absolutely.
Areas are more populated.
It's one of these things where with tornado data, it's really difficult because of, you know, when Doppler radar came along and we've got all of these storm chasers out there. So we've got a natural trend just by virtue of technology and more folks tracking tornadoes. But that is really, I think, an incredibly active field of research right now. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there.
So is it fair to say that warmer weather creates extreme weather?
Yes, it is. Certain kinds of extremes. I think, you know, one way to look at it is if you increase the Earth's average temperature by about 1.4 degrees, which is what we've done, you see that penetrate into the weather in especially heat extremes. So we expect heat waves, and you can think of March as sort of a springtime example of a heat wave. We expect them to last longer, which this one did, to affect broader areas, which this one did, and to be more intense, which this one was. So it was kind of, you know, storybook type of incident that we expect to see more and more of. We also see it play out in terms of rainfall events. So we expect to see more intense, heavy rainfall events when they happen.
So if it's been a warmer spring, does that mean that we're going to have a really hot summer?
You know, it's funny because intuitively, I feel like a lot of us are feeling that way now. Like, oh, my goodness, if March was this warm, if you know, December, January, February were warm, we're totally toast this summer.
Yeah.
And it's not the case. I mean, there's no correlation really across what happens in winter and what happens in the summer. It's hard to say exactly how much warmer the summer will be. But, you know, I will say the Climate Prediction Center, part of NOAA, indicates an above average summer.
So given all this, are we in trouble?
I think what we have in front of us is a case of an issue where the sooner we get started working on it, the better. The thing about climate change is that there's time lags in the system. So you can argue that the climate change that we're seeing right now is a byproduct of what we did in the 1980s, right? I often hear folks say, well, let's just wait and see how bad it gets. And that sounds kind of rational. But because of the time lags in the system, if you wait, you've really got problems. So it's this exercise in trusting long-range forecasts for the future, trusting the science, essentially, because the science tells us that if we don't do anything about this problem, you know, by the middle and the end of the century, we're looking at really a radically different climate.
That's Heidi Cullen. She's chief climatologist at Climate Central and author of The Weather of the Future. Turning globally, this week, the UN International Panel on Climate Change released a report. It says we're more likely to face extreme weather events in coming decades, things like more intense heat waves, heavier rainfalls, longer droughts. But the report doesn't focus on things we can do to prevent or slow climate change. Instead, it tells people how to cope better with weather disasters it says we're all more likely to face. Christopher Field, a climate scientist at Stanford, was a top editor on the report.
The statistics on disaster loss are interesting and tragic. What you see historically is that the economic losses tend to be greatest in the developed countries, but the loss of life tends to be overwhelmingly concentrated. 95% of recent loss of life has been in the world's developing countries. That doesn't mean that developing countries never take smart steps to deal with disasters, however. We've seen dramatic improvement in Bangladesh, for example. Bangladesh had some of the most destructive tropical cyclones in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And by the time Tropical Cyclone Cedar hit in 2007, they'd implemented a whole series of smart, relatively low-cost strategies that really minimized loss of life.
What did they do different?
Bangladesh had a history of experience, and they really made three kinds of investments. They made platforms where livestock could be raised above the storm surge or where people could gather. They implemented early warning systems and made sure that people knew that they should move to high ground when storms were predicted. And they also established civilian response teams so that disaster aid was more quickly delivered and much more effectively delivered as a consequence, mainly of volunteer efforts. One of the things that's impressive about these investments that Bangladesh made is that they weren't terribly expensive, but they were very effective.
Christopher, Bangladesh has made such strides. What cities have not made strides?
What we see is two kinds of places where those strategies aren't really being deployed. One is areas so resource-strapped that they don't have, you can think of it as the bandwidth to make the investments that are necessary. And in areas that have high levels of civil strife, that really tends to be a problem. And the other place is areas that are vulnerable but haven't had a recent experience that have driven home that vulnerability.
So if you were to look at a map, where would you point to?
The problem with trying to draw a map is we know that essentially every part of the world is vulnerable to some kind of an extreme or a disaster. I think if you had asked U.S. citizens prior to Hurricane Katrina if there was a major vulnerability to a Category 4 hurricane, people would have said, you know, it's a risk, but it's one that we think we have under control. Once the hurricane occurred, we knew that there were gaps in our preparation and in our responsibility. When we look at where the extremes have occurred in the United States over the last year, we see them essentially everywhere. Droughts in the west, floods in the northeast, tornadoes in the middle. It really is the case that there is no place on the map that is totally immune to climate extremes and disasters.
Christopher Field is the director of the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. By the way, there are some places still fending off winter. This Easter Sunday, northern Maine could see 4 inches of snow. Not such great news for all the plants that thought it was spring just a few weeks ago. Stay with us. You're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. For more than a century, parents of deaf children had few options when it came to finding an education for their children. Most sent their kids to boarding schools for the deaf. Many of the children and the schools thrived in the shadows, embracing a distinct deaf culture. But recent advances in medicine and technology are now reshaping what it means to be deaf in America. Children who could never hear a sound are now adults who can hear everything. And that is having a dramatic impact on the nation's historic deaf schools, as well as on the lives of people like Shahzad Zaman. Zaman was born deaf 31 years ago to a family where everyone else could hear. His parents were worried. They wanted him to fit into a hearing world.
My parents wanted me to learn how to be able to listen and to be able to speak despite not being able to hear.
Zaman went to a special school for the deaf at first. But in third grade, his parents changed their mind. They sent him to therapy to teach him to read lips. And then they moved him to his neighborhood school in Long Island, New York. He learned to play sports and make friends, but it was never easy.
You know, all my peers were able to use a telephone and, you know, have conversations at noisy restaurants. And it was actually getting harder and harder for me to have a conversation outside of one-on-one or one-on-two.
But then, the summer before his senior year, a small miracle happened. A new piece of technology called a cochlear implant was helping deaf people hear. Doctors surgically inserted one into his ear. He woke up, and the world was an entirely new place.
At that time, I didn't know what I was hearing. You know, I was hearing so many different things that sounded so mechanical, and I was hearing the air conditioner or running water or the bird chirping, and I didn't know what it was. So it really took some time for my brain to really to process. You know, I would have to sit in the backyard as you try to absorb all the sounds.
More than half of all deaf children are now getting cochlear implants, and every year the number increases. 1 in 4 deaf adults also now have it, though it takes longer for adult brains to adapt to hearing sound. For Zaman, the decision to get an implant was practical as well as emotional. He wanted to go to med school, and he knew a doctor needed to hear.
In medicine, it's not acceptable to be able to hear 70% of the information, because that can make a difference in terms of the quality of patient care. So I was always trying to, you know, get up to 100% accuracy in terms of understanding the information.
Today, he's a physician in Sacramento, and last year he received a second cochlear implant in his other ear, which has brought his hearing to close to 100%. He says he no longer thinks about not being able to hear. Only in rare moments, when there's a lot of noise, does he search for someone's lips.
You know, we live in a hearing world, in a hearing society, you know, so it's really important to be able to hear. And I was just happy because, you know, I would be able to have much more ease in terms of communicating with people.
Zaman is already on his fourth upgrade of the device. And Dr. John Naparco, an ear specialist at Johns Hopkins Hospital, says there will be many more in the years ahead.
Just like our cell phones, our laptops are getting smaller, faster, smarter. Cochlear implants are becoming smarter in terms of bringing in the most important sound signals that are in the environment to the ear of the implant listener.
Experts say while they know that 1 in 1,000 children are born genetically deaf every year, it's almost impossible to track the rate of deafness over time. Hearing impairment is a spectrum, and it changes. So have its causes. Diseases like rubella, scarlet fever, and measles that have caused hearing loss have all but been eradicated by vaccines. But more premature babies with hearing loss are surviving. There also appears to be more children with autism, which has been linked to hearing difficulties. But what is certain is that more than half of the children who once were deaf, for whatever reason, can now hear. Dr. Naparco has performed hundreds of the surgeries.
Well, the cochlear implant's a remarkable technology that can take in sound waves, much like a hearing aid would. But instead of simply amplifying those sound waves and delivering them to the eardrum, what the cochlear implant does is to take that energy and translate it into an electrical code. That code is sent along a series of contacts which are placed directly next to the hearing nerve. And through microcurrent injections, through small packets of electricity, we can activate that hearing nerve, thus recreating the active hearing.
And will that work for most deaf people?
For the vast majority of deaf people, there is in fact a viable, vital hearing nerve that retains its responsiveness to this kind of stimulation.
If the majority of deaf cases can be treated by the cochlear implant, why doesn't everybody get one?
There remains, unfortunately, a socioeconomic divide with respect to access to cochlear implantation.
How much does it cost to get one?
The device itself is about $32,000. The hospital costs and surgery add another $10,000 to $12,000 on that.
So does insurance cover it?
Insurance generally does cover it, although there are some, unfortunately, some Medicaid programs now that have constrained access.
If parents have a child today that's born deaf, what can they expect in the years ahead? I mean, might their child become just fully integrated in mainstream society and, even be just taken for a hearing person?
We fully expect that a child without other disabilities is, in fact, going to be fully mainstreamed within 3 to 5 years of receiving a cochlear implant.
Do you think that means that there will be a time in the future where deafness is a choice?
Well, I think we're already there, Laura. As individuals have learned more and more about this technology, they have learned that it wasn't developed as a referendum on deaf culture. It is a natural outgrowth of the technology boom that we have seen in our society over the past 30 years. But as technologies tend to evolve, cultures tend to evolve, and we may be seeing a new culture evolved that uses this technology, but still has foundations in the deaf world.
That's Dr. John Naparco from Johns Hopkins Hospital. For everything this technology has done for deaf people, it has created an uncertain future for deaf schools across the country. Dr. Richard Miyamoto is a former board member of the Indiana School for the Deaf.
Deaf kids have changed, so I think the schools are going to have to change.
More than 80% of children who are or were hearing impaired now attend their local schools. Just a couple decades ago, those kids attended deaf schools because there weren't any other options.
In the past, we really didn't have much to offer to deaf children, so they would automatically just be in the sign culture and would grow up that way, and that was comfortable for them. But when cochlear implants came along and there was something to be done for deaf children, many of them were successful, so they ended up living their lives in the hearing world rather than the deaf world.
Miyamoto says the drop in enrollment has led many deaf schools to rethink their mission.
What deaf schools have done is brought in many more complex kids with multiply handicapping situations, which are probably not part of their usual student population.
It's critical, however, that deaf schools adjust, Miyamoto says, not disappear.
Oh, I think there's clearly a place for the traditional deaf schools because not everyone does well with the current technology.
So this is like a fifth grade classroom. Let's just go in and take a look real quick at one.
Ed Bosso opens the door to fifth grade at the Kendall Demonstration Elementary School on the campus of Gallaudet University, the nation's premier deaf college.
These tables are grouped in a semicircle right around the teacher's desk.
Bosso heads the elementary and high school here. The desks in this classroom all face each other with the teacher at the head. Bosso explains that this school is bilingual. It teaches in sign, but it also teaches English out loud. That's the way this school has always taught. But even he can sense change is coming. There are 265 students here.
How does that compare to decades past? More, less, about the same?
Oh, it's less. That's less. If you look at the history of schools for the deaf, there was a point in time where these schools were burgeoning because of the rubella bulge. I mean, at that time, rubella caused deafness. We didn't know it. The medications around it caused deafness, and so we had a huge group of students who were deaf because of that.
When was that?
Started in the 60s into the 70s, 80s.
At one point, the school had more than 500 students.
So now we have here one first grade, one second grade, one third grade, one fourth grade. Back then, we probably had two first grades or three first grades, three second grades. So there were more peers.
Then in 1975, Congress passed the Education for All Handicapped Children Act. It mandated all schools accommodate children with disabilities.
The law said kids should be, to the maximum extent appropriate, be educated in their home school with non-disabled peers. So people start there. And what often happens is kids fail their way into the deaf school.
These days, the school has found a niche helping students adjust to their implants before they leave for a traditional school.
Even a kid who's born and gets implanted, until that implant starts working, until they can listen to learn, they have to learn to listen. So while they're learning to listen, learning to use their device, they're missing a lot.
The school is also now reaching out to children with multiple disabilities in addition to hearing loss. One of the more common is autism.
We are seeing students that are having additional disabilities at our doorstep, and people need to know how to serve them. And so we're going to try and fill that gap and support people nationally in that.
If it sounds like Bosso is navigating the issue delicately, he is. It's a touchy subject for some at the school, breaking from decades of tradition and history. But the change has already come. This year, one in five students have a second separate disability, in addition to not being able to hear. Stay with us on Weekends on All Things Considered. Math teachers know that fractions can be hard for the average third grader. Teachers at a public school in San Bruno, California, are trying something new. They're teaching difficult math concepts through music. As Caitlin Esch reports, they're getting results.
Pick up the drumsticks. One, two, ready, go.
At Allen Elementary School, a room full of third graders sits facing music instructor Endra Ballo. They're back straight, eyes ahead, beating a mouse pad with drumsticks. These students are learning fractions. Nine-year-old Dante Arevelo explains.
2 8s plus 6 8s. You have 8 8s, but since it's in the music, it equals a whole note.
The program is called Academic Music, and it works like this. First, students learn the basics of reading notes. Then they learn how to add notes, which is essentially adding fractions. Now, Ballo is drawing the music notes on a board and adding them together.
What should I write on the top here? How many 8 notes do you see?
4.
Good job. Now, I wonder, what should I write here? Because this is tricky. Yeah.
From there, it gets harder. Students learn how to add uncommon denominators and multiply fractions. San Francisco State University researcher Susan Corey designed the curriculum with Ballo in 2007 because, as a former third grade teacher, she knows how tricky fractions can be.
If you say what's bigger, 1/8 or 1/4, they'll say 1/8 because 8 is bigger than 4.
Corey says it's all about visualization.
But our students, because of the notes, know that all those little tiny eighth notes are a lot smaller than a whole note or a half note.
Ready? Play.
In this class, more than half the students are English language learners. Classroom teacher Gina Greitz says academic music has especially helped her students, like a little girl who volunteers to solve a problem even though she barely speaks English.
And she knew that it was four counts and put it into a fraction. And just to have her get up and present in front of a class is a really big deal. And she raised her hand and wanted to. So I'm seeing a lot of these kids open up and want to try it instead of hiding behind the desk and saying, please don't call on me.
A recent study found students that went through the program tested better on fractions. The average score of the academic music students was nearly double that of the regular math class students. Curriculum creator Susan Corey says even low-performing students did better.
That's what I, as a classroom teacher, want. I want to know that those students who typically are the underachievers are benefiting from the instruction that I'm providing.
In a less formal study, Allen Elementary School teachers compared their kids' math scores with third graders in other district schools. Again, Allen students performed better. Back in the classroom, 9-year-old Eric Bogren says he'd never played an instrument before academic music.
It's really easy when it's music, but it's harder to do it when you're doing math.
For Bogren, thinking of fractions as music notes helps. The curriculum designers hope to eventually make the program available for any third grade teacher to use in the classroom. For NPR News, I'm Caitlin Esch.
After 9/11, there was one man the American public wanted captured, Osama bin Laden. But there was a secret hunt going on for someone else, the real mastermind of the attacks.
If Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had been taken off the battlefield or captured when the authorities had a chance to do that in the mid-90s, there simply would have not been a 9/11 attack.
That's Josh Meyer. And along with Terry McDermott, he co-authored a book called The Hunt for KSM, Inside the Pursuit and Takedown of the Real 9/11 Mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. This week, the Department of Defense filed charges against KSM, who has been held at Guantanamo since 2006. He's accused of being responsible for the deaths of 2,970 people and will stand trial before a military tribunal at Guantanamo Bay. As he was researching his book, Josh Meyer found Khalid Sheikh Mohammed complex and surprising.
He's quite a fascinating individual. He's incredibly charismatic. He's extremely intelligent. He's able to meet people and get them to do things like, you know, blow themselves up for the cause within a matter of, you know, days or weeks. I mean, he's got this almost Svengali effect on people. He's also kind of a jokester and a prankster. He likes to crack jokes. I mean, in Guantanamo, he would make jokes at one point, but then he would all of a sudden have this Charles Manson-like stare. I mean, he's a very complicated guy. Even when he was on the run, they found a suitcase with all of his belongings, and it showed a lot of photos of him playing with his young children. So in some ways, he was a very doting family man.
A few people may realize that he actually attended college here in the United States. How did that experience go for him?
Yeah, I mean, he got an engineering degree from North Carolina Agricultural and Technical, and I think that's one of the reasons he had such a chip on his shoulder against the United States. He encountered pretty serious discrimination. There were some guys at the college who liked to put, you know, like a pail of water on the door so that when they opened it, it spilled into the room. I mean, I think that he came back from that experience thinking that the United States was evil. But I also think that it went far beyond that. I think that he was really fixated on what he thought were problems in American foreign policy. He was much more political than bin Laden and these other guys. I mean, he was religious too, but, you know, he hung around in karaoke bars. He drank alcohol. He, you know, picked up dancing girls in the Philippines. So he was not your typical jihadist.
But for a long time, the U.S. intelligence community had no idea from your book that this was even the guy that they were after. They had heard rumors and whispers of some guy named Mukhtar, which I guess means
the brain or the chosen one.
Right. Why did it take them so long to figure out, even after the fact, that this was the guy?
It wasn't that they didn't know who KSM was. There was a small group of people, mostly the FBI agents from the New York field office, who were tracking KSM from 1993 well into 2003. The big problem was they didn't connect them to Al-Qaeda until 2002.
Wow, you called him a ghost.
Right. And then once they connected him to 9/11, everybody said, oh my God, this guy that's been on our radar for so long is actually the guy that did 9/11. And that was just a complete panic moment. I mean, it basically rang all the way up to the White House immediately. Satellites were retasked to try to find this guy. And it essentially was a redeployment of the whole war on terrorism.
And it was just an all-out manhunt.
Right.
For him.
Right, but it was in secret. And that's what intrigued me for so long, was while bin Laden was in the headlines every day and there were military people, you know, soldiers looking for him and bombing Afghanistan, the hunt for KSM was a guns-drawn chase through the streets of places like Karachi by law enforcement, and it was kept in secret for many, many months.
Why did they do that? I mean, the public, we all sort of understood that Osama bin Laden was the guy we were after, that this is who we were chasing in caves in Afghanistan.
Right.
In your book, you describe in such detail that who we were really chasing at that time was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Why would they keep that a secret? Why was that important to do that?
They say it was because they wanted to have the element of surprise to catch him. But they didn't catch him. There were a group of agents from the FBI field office who went through as many as 30 countries over 8 years looking for him, and they came close to catching him a few times, but every time he was one step ahead of them and he got away.
I'm speaking with Josh Meyer about the book he co-authored called The Hunt for KSM, Inside the Pursuit and Takedown of the Real 9/11 Mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Josh, your book shows so much that the CIA and the FBI does right. I mean, just such moments of just amazing work. And then there are moments where you just think this could not have gone any worse for an agency.
Right. I think that one of the fundamental disconnects, which, you know, continues to this day, is that the CIA and the FBI essentially have competing agendas. One is to gather intelligence and prevent future attacks. The other is to gather evidence to be presented in a court of law and make criminal cases against people. And those two just don't mix.
And both the CIA and the FBI had these incredible missed opportunities to have prevented 9/11 from happening.
Well, I mean, I think that the one thing that's the most important takeaway from this is that the small group of people that were hunting him in some ways were real true American heroes. You had a guy named Frank Pellegrino, who was a former accountant and a lawyer who was a very idiosyncratic FBI agent, and he realized the dangers of KSM early on. He had a lot of trouble finding other FBI agents to work with him on this because, you know, it was hard work, it was a lot of international travel, and to get promoted in the FBI, you're basically promoted on the number of arrests you make and cases you make, and that doesn't happen in terrorism. So he looked around and he found a guy who was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, who was a Port Authority cop named Matt Bashir. And then these two guys basically traveled the world together, and they basically gave up their lives, you know, their family life and so on, and spent most of their time overseas hunting KSM. The problem was that after a while, the FBI New York office, FBI headquarters, the Justice Department started thinking, well, you guys are spending way too much time looking for this one guy. I mean, you know, how dangerous can he be? So they were actually criticized and undermined for not participating in what was believed to be the most important threat, which was Al-Qaeda, when it turns out that the guy they were chasing was the guy who did 9/11. So there's an irony there that's rather unfortunate.
How did he end up getting caught?
KSM was finally captured through a combination of methods. Some of them are still very secret. A lot of it was just shoe leather detective work. They would catch one person and get some information that would lead to another person. But one of the big successes in the catch for KSM was that they developed an informant who was a Baluchi from the same part of Baluchistan that KSM was from. And he was in KSM's orbit of people that he knew and trusted, and they were able to insert this person into KSM's circle of trusted confidants. And at one point, he was able to set up a meeting with KSM. And so while they're in the meeting, he goes to the bathroom and he texts, "I am with KSM," and that's how they knew that he was with him. Then they waited till the meeting was over, and then they took some other measures, which are classified, and then they captured KSM. And in the end, even though this is the most dramatic law enforcement manhunt probably in history, spanning 18 months even after 9/11, KSM was captured in his sleep.
Why did Khalid Sheikh Mohammed do it?
He would be happy to tell you that, and I think that if he's given a chance in the upcoming trial, he'll do that. I mean, he is very open about his grievances. He thinks of himself as the equivalent of George Washington, the commanding general of an insurgent army fighting the British. I mean, he really believes that he is the good guy in all this and that he's fighting a war to protect Muslims from a U.S. government that he believes is propping up corrupt dictators around the world launching wars that kill innocent people. So he's got a very articulated position on this, and he really does believe that he's the good guy and we're the bad guys.
That's Josh Meyer, along with Terry McDermott. He co-authored a book called The Hunt for KSM, Inside the Pursuit and Takedown of the Real 9/11 Mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Josh, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Time now for music. This is currently the number 3 song in the country. It's called Somebody I Used to Know, and it's by an Australian artist known as Gotye. He's been big in Australia for a few years now, but this song started an avalanche in the UK, Germany, South Africa, Israel. Everywhere it's landed, it's been a massive hit. And now, even here in the United States.
Now and then I think of when we were together. Like when you said you felt so happy you could die. I told myself that you were right for me, but felt so lonely in your company. But that was love and to make us still remember.
Gotye is sometimes known by his real name, Wally DeBacker, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome, Wally.
How you doing?
This song that we were just listening to is a duet with a singer named Kimbra. Tell me about what is going on with the two characters in this song.
Well, they're both fairly unreliable narrators, which I think is one of the strengths the song has. When Kimbra enters about 3/4 of the way through the tune, she brings most of what I've sung into question.
Now and then I think of all the times you screwed.
And then I think what I sing afterwards brings most of what she kind of sings into question. So, yeah, it's fairly open like that, I think, in a possibly confusing but maybe also intriguing way.
You said that you could let it go, and I wouldn't catch you hung up on somebody that you used to know. But you didn't have to cut me off, because I could never happen to know we were nothing. I don't even need your love, but you treat me like a stranger, and I feel so rough.
To me, I guess that felt like one of the most truthful aspects of writing this song was that a lot of people's experience, you know, in relationships and after, you know, a relationship breaks up is of sometimes confusion and the fog of memory can sometimes get, you know, definitely in the way of anything being very clear.
This song, Somebody That I Used to Know, is so incredibly popular right now, but it almost didn't even get made.
It almost didn't get finished.
Five months or something? What happened?
I actually wrote it fairly quickly. And then, you know, when I struck upon the idea of introducing another perspective, I wrote the female part. And then the big challenge, I guess, the 5 months you mention of waiting and wondering whether I might ever finish the tune was all about trying to find the right female vocalist to complete it. And that was a lot of waiting and a fairly frustrating experience.
Did you go through several?
I tried it with a few different vocalists, some who sounded, I thought, really great, but it didn't, in the end, after some consideration, just didn't end up sounding quite right. So I was kind of back to square one going, yeah, no, it's still... I haven't found the right person.
Is that hard, though, to bring somebody in and then say, no, thank you?
It was in one instance because, we were friends. But I think, you know, she was understanding. And it was interesting because for her it had been perhaps, at least on some level, something of an intellectual exercise because I'd kind of asked her in a way to try and sing in a way she wouldn't often naturally sing. And she was really interested to try that as, you know, a craft type of approach. And so in the end, she was kind of like, well, that was still interesting and I understand. That's cool.
I'm speaking with Wally DeBacker, better known as Gotye. His album is called Making Mirrors. I want to talk about all the different musical styles that you have on this album, and there are so many. The song State of the Art starts off like Henry Mancini's lost reggae album. And
I like that.
And then all of a sudden the vocals come in.
When the cotillion arrived, you threw out the television.
I mean, it's pretty disorienting. You're really pushing the limits of autotune, it seems like.
Yeah, this was like, I took a bit of a different approach with this. I ended up singing the melody of this song in a monotone on one note, sort of up high, higher maybe than any note that's in the actual melody of the song. And then I manually went through and shifted each note from that monotone performance down to the arc of the melody.
And you're the state of the art.
magic swing piano really is astounding. And we can't tell them apart. These amazing simulations end up sounding even better than the real thing.
I didn't want it to sort of sound robotic. I wanted it to sound like a peculiar, sort of human but not human character.
So was that the inspiration behind wanting to do it this way? Because there's a lyric in the song that says, these amazing simulations end up sounding even better than the real thing. I mean, was that facetious?
No, I mean, the song is like this. Well, on the one hand, it's like a love song to an electronic organ that sits in my lounge room, which was given to me, secondhand purchased by my parents. So, yeah, on some level, the song is kind of just like a love song to a piece of technology. But then when the song and the lyrics sort of became about that organ, I realized, I think at some stage, it became a little bit like a reflection on the nature of how people can relate to inanimate objects and pieces of technology and to the kind of bold promise that technology at certain periods seems to give us of, you know, this possible future, this bright future. And especially, I think, I mean, about how that promise of that future can very quickly become very quaint and almost impossible for a future generation to understand because technology dates so quickly. So on some level, maybe the weird voice is kind of like, I imagine maybe it's myself in 20, 30 years' time, or maybe it's already like a middle-aged organ enthusiast who is trying pretty hard but can't really convince his wife or his kids that these amazing simulations of violins and vibrato trumpets are interesting.
There are so many different musical styles within this record, and it seems like it just has one sort of joyous moment after another. Smoke and Mirrors certainly took a turn in a different direction.
Mm. You're a fraud and you know it,
but it's too good to throw it all away. Anyone would do the same. You're a fraud and you know it, but it's too good to throw it all away. Anyone would do the same. You've got to keep it going. Mm. What were you going through when you wrote that?
It comes from a feeling of not always being confident that, I don't know, I have a right somehow to, I don't know, do certain things in music, or that I feel, you know, not good enough a lot of the time, I'm really challenging myself and falling short a lot of the time.
I mean, I read that you had said before that you had struggled with depression, and that while you were making this particular record, or is that something that you sort of struggled with for a long time?
There were moments making this record where I felt like, you know, I would get up in the morning and go, I wonder if this is, am I really depressed, because I'm struggling, like, really deeply at times. And, so I'd say that's a certain level of depression.
Well, then you follow this very introspective song, which is just full of self-doubt and questioning, with a song called I Feel Better.
No obfuscation there.
I feel better.
Do you like being a rock star?
I don't think I'm a rock star.
No?
Rock star, really? I don't know.
You see yourself as a musician?
Sometimes I felt like I've become less a musician, you know, more kind of, I don't know, just a tinkerer, cobbler, you know, a self-made producer, songwriter, and probably took 7 or 8 years before I took a chance and quit my day job, and my folks allowed me to move back home for a few months, and I kind of eked it out trying to work out whether some record sales and royalties and live gigs would actually, you know, start paying the bills. And thankfully, for maybe 4 years since then, it's, you know, it's kind of continued. But yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like a musician more than I do a rock star.
Wally DeBacker is better known as Gautier. His album is called Making Mirrors, and you can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Thank you so much for coming in.
No worries. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program is directed by Phil Harrell. It is produced by Kenya Young, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, Becky Sullivan, Petra Mayer, and Amy Held. Mathani Maturi is our senior editor. Steve Lichtig is our senior producer. I'm Laura Sullivan. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 on Saturdays and Sundays.